organized outline for this conversation.
That's right. So essentially, like, one of the things that we wanted to do when we started this, because so Riddles in the Dark began as a way of guessing what the Hobbit film was going to do. It started when the Hobbit films were about to come out. So in the year prior to the release of the first Hobbit film, we were walking through and talking about what are the challenges for adaptation? Like, you know, what needs to happen? What do we hope to see? How do we think they're going to, you know, address some of these things which we think are going to be really interesting or difficult to do in adapting? And then we even had this whole, like, scoring system. So we actually had a riddle. We had, a question which we had to come down and give an answer to. You know, here's what we think is going to happen.
Yes.
Each of our episodes. And then we had scoring when the film came out to see, like, how many of us, you know, how we did and how...
Which turned out to be harder than you would expect.
Yeah,
it was like,
exactly.
There was many questions where we're like, not really sure. Like, we learned how to formulate questions that were likely to be answered by the actual...
That's right. Yeah, the first one, we had a lot of, so none of the above, I guess.
Yeah.
That's really kind of the answer to that. But this is also, I mean, one of the fun things that came from this was, like, a set of very idiosyncratic reactions as a viewer when I first saw the first Hobbit films, because I was completely focused from a Riddles in the Dark perspective. So I'll never forget when...
Yeah.
When Azog holds up the severed head of Thror, right? And I stood up and cheered because I had called that. We debated the question, like, will the decapitated head of Thror appear on screen? And I was like, yeah, it totally will. So he holds up the head and I'm like, yes! Everyone around me is like, what is wrong with this guy? Anyway, so it was different. It was
Azog
different.
Azog fans represent, right?
Exactly. Anyway.
Yeah, so that the core of it was the prediction game, but really the meat or substance of the podcast, or the most satisfying part, was the, like, talking through, in speculating about the questions, it was talking through, like, the challenges of adaptation. And like, that was so, that was sort of the thing where, like, well, we'd like to kind of keep doing this. It's really...
By season three, we had these like, diverting threads, right?
Yeah.
Where first it was just like, okay, how do we think we're going to do this one? By the season three, we're like, okay, we now have the, here's what we think would be great, and here's what we think Peter Jackson's actually going to do. So, like, there was this, like, you know, divergence between those paths. So in the end, one way of thinking about film is that we just fired Peter Jackson.
Yes.
Basically, we're like, okay, you can't be trusted to enact these awesome ideas that we're coming up with. We have no illusions that this is what you're actually going to do. But darn it, we want to keep talking about how we would do this. And so we decided to go to territory that we knew was safe. Nothing was on the horizon. But we were like, okay, let's talk about the Silmarillion, which nobody can adapt. So that, therefore, we know not only will we be untrammeled by the restrictions of reality as far as film production is concerned, we will also be untainted by anybody else's screen adaptation,
right,
because it can't happen.
Yes.
So we started talking through the Silmarillion from the beginning. You know, the goal was to do From Ino Indole through, well, basically, we're kind of now, it's like the entire story. So we're basically going from the Ino Indole through Sam's departure on the boat.
Yeah.
Basically, that's going to be the final episode of the final season. It'll be a while that this is going on. And it's funny because Riddles in the Dark seemed like such a huge project when we started it. And we were like, okay, are we really going to be able to commit to doing this podcast for 3 solid years, you know, while these films are coming out? And now we've done 3 years of film, and it's like the first 10% of our content. I mean, it's where have we even begun? But it really has been illuminating. Not only just in, it's not just fun thinking in terms of, like, in a sort of a fan way, right? Of, like, what would it look like? Wouldn't it be cool if you, like, take your favorite stories from the Silmarillion and think about what that would look like and kind of, you know, sort of live in that imaginative space. But really in the sort of the opportunities for interpretation, there are so many things about the Silmarillion story that I have, and not only the Silmarillion story, but of Tolkien's world, that thinking through in this kind of systematic way has really compelled me to confront things that I'd never ever confronted before, you know. And it's just it's been a really it's an angle at sort of discussing and analyzing the text that I never would have thought of 5 years ago, you know, but is immensely rewarding, and I've learned so much about the Silmarillion so far. For those of you who don't follow the series, let me explain the parameters of what we've done. Just, I won't go through all the details, all the decisions we've made, but just so that if you have questions, you want to talk about things, you can know what are the things we've discussed and can talk in detail about the things we've thought through and what's the stuff we haven't gotten to yet. So I want to kind of lay that out. We've done three seasons. The arc of the first season, this first season is primarily the story of the Valar. So it starts with the Ainur Lindale and goes through the chaining of Melkor. Okay, and the sort of the pivotal moment in the middle of the season is the destruction of the lamps, which we played as the sort of, well, we can talk about that later. One of the, you know, thinking about what I was talking about earlier today with faithfulness and things, a bunch of very significant changes we've made. That'd be a really fun thing for us to discuss. Or what are some of the biggest ways in which we decided to leave the text behind, and why did we decide that? Anyway, so that's season one, was the story of the Valar. I still my favorite episode title that we've come up with is the season finale of season one, which is when the Valar go and they attack Utumno and take him. And when the title of that episode is "The War to Begin All Wars," which I was like, that's still the best title we've come up with.
Pretty good naming.
Yeah. Anyway, so then the second season follows primarily the story of the elves, especially the Noldor. It began the episode one is the awakening of the elves in Quivienna, which we kind of work and sort of tease a little bit at the end of the first season. But Quivienna in episode one, through the darkening of Valinor at the end and that's chronologically one of the, I mean, of course, who even knows how much time passed in season one, right? But there's an accelerated timeline in season two, which was challenging. But the first half of the season is primarily the decisions of the elves and their journeys across Middle-earth. Everybody who's going to get to Valinor gets there by the middle of the season. And so the turning point at the middle of season two is the parole of Melkor, right? His release from Mandos and being put into general population / house arrest in Valinor. And then, of course, the second half of the season focuses on Fëanor and the unrest of the Noldor and Melkor's interactions with them, leading up, of course, to the darkening of Valinor, which is the final episode of the death of Finwë and the destruction of the trees at the end of season two. Season three, which we just finished recently, is the return to Beleriand. So the first episode is Fëanor's speech in Tirion, recruiting everybody to come to Middle-earth and reclaim the Silmarils. Episode two is the Kinslaying, right? And then we go up through the rising of the sun. So the final episode has the capture of Maedhros and him being stapled to the cliffside, and the arrival of Fingolfin on the shores of Beleriand, and the rising of the sun. Mm-hmm. And the sort of in the middle, the kind of turning point in the middle of season three is the burning of the ships, the arrival of the Noldor and the burning of the ships. We do a lot with the Sindar as well, with Thingol and the Sindar, the arrival of the Green Elves and the battle with the Orcs, which leads to the large-scale destruction of most of the Green Elves, and the death of Denethor, their leader, is a major feature in the first half of season three. So that's what we've done so far. Season four, what the episode you missed, Dave, was we're trying to figure out we're still trying to decide the scope of season four. Originally, we had very casually said, well, we'll go from right after that, you know, from the rescue of Maedhros and the establishment of the kingdoms in Beleriand up through the Dagobah Bragollach, the Battle of Sudden Flame and the breaking of the siege. So we'll do that, like, establishment of kingdoms and the siege of Angband stuff in season four. But we've had a revolt essentially, I think I would say, from our supporting cast, that one of the things that's been, we was our sort of our vision for Sim Film from the beginning, is that it not just be a podcast, us getting together and talking, you know, every couple of weeks, but it really be a community effort. And we have a very devoted group of people who have been very heavily involved from the beginning in helping to plan things, and they do full script outlines for each episode they write, and they do. We have people who've costume design and character
visualization. There's a lot of work on like what should the Valar look like.
Yeah, map making and scores. A musician who's composed themes and scores for most of the season so far. Yeah. Really cool stuff because he came up with like these core musical themes for each one of the Valar in season one. Was like, what do you know? So we have like, this is the Manwë theme, this is the Olmo theme, which of course can then be taken and adapted in other ways. Like then he came up with a fall theme, like for, you know, the theme that plays like while people are falling or experiencing temptation, right, which may lead to their fall. Another one about like making and glory and beauty and things like that. So, and the way that he's now sort of combining these, right? So there was the original Myron theme. Myron, of course, Sauron's original name before he, you know, got a red lightsaber. So he, like with the original Myron theme, right? And then like the Myron theme gets combined with the fall theme, right? Which like combines to form the Sauron theme. And anyway, we've got this whole community who are doing all this really cool creative work. And they're the ones who revolted. They were like, no, there is too much. We cannot do that in one season. So insisted would be harsh. Threatened would not be quite right, but they really want us to split our original concept of season four into two seasons. All right. They decided that the chapter of Beleriand and its realms was too rich in narrative content for season alone. So we need
a season to itself.
We need two seasons for of Beleriand and its realms. Yeah. But again, that's actually another really cool thing because just like as Christy was talking about with the example of Celebrimbor, as you know, Tolkien's work is so rich in these untold stories or only glimpsed stories, and there are a bunch of these that we really want to do. So, like for instance, one of the things that came up, there are two love stories actually, or sort of love stories, both of which fall into this period, and which would be really interesting to tell together, and both of them as a really interesting setup for the Beren and Lúthien story, which is, of course, what comes next, right, after this period that we're doing now. And those are the story of Arathel and Eol, right, which is really interesting. And the by far the darkest love story that Tolkien ever wrote. And one of our Signum students, Kate Neville, gave a paper at a conference, the Vermont Tolkien Conference year before last, which was a really cool paper where she was arguing, I thought really compellingly, that when you really look at it, the Eol and Arathel story is almost exactly like the mirror reverse of the Beren and Lúthien story. Mm-hmm. It's like the Beren and Lúthien story in this like, negative image mirror. And it's really interesting. I mean, so thinking, really wanting to take some time with that, right? One of the arguments that Marie Prosser, who's been our primary driving force and sort of leader of our creative team, her primary argument was, look, if we do this in one season, Arathel's going to barely even move into Gondolin before she's sick of it and wants to leave. You know, we need to get to let the Gondolin story develop, you know, to get that sense of like they have been sequestered for a really long time and Arathel is sick of it, and not just make her look petty. Be like, oh, Gondolin, it's really nice, but you know, I want to leave, right? The risk of making her character look really shallow. The other love story is the one that's not in the Silmarillion at all. This is the other really fun thing, is drawing on the later writings of Tolkien that never got integrated into the Silmarillion. And this is the story of Ignor and Andreth. Mm. Okay, so for those of you who have read Morgoth's Ring, volume 10 of the history of Middle-earth, may know the story of the Athrabeth of Finrod and Endreth, which is this debate between Finrod Felagund and Endreth, this wise mortal woman, who are discussing, it's mostly a theological debate, but it's a much more deeply personal than a purely theological debate. It's a very non-theoretical theological debate, which has a lot of relevance to them personally. And it, by the way, that's probably my second favorite short piece Tolkien ever wrote. I absolutely love the Athrabeth, and can't recommend that. And even if you're not a History of Middle-earth person, find the Athrabeth of Finrod and Endreth and read it, because it's awesome. What is revealed by the end of that discussion is that Endreth is in love with Eignor, the Noldor brother of Finrod. And Eignor returns her love, but won't marry her. He chooses not. So there is this reverse gender Beren and Lúthien moment, which predates Beren and Lúthien chronologically, but the elf says no. He decides that this would not be good, this would not be right, and now is not the time, because it was right. And of course, in a sense, he was right. The Dagor Bragalach is about to happen, and he dies in it, in fact. So there's some sense of his own foreknowledge of his own doom to come, and also just the general fact that, as Tolkien said, elves don't marry or have children in time of war. Which, of course, if you're immortal, makes sense, right? It's an inconvenient time, family issues during wartime, right? And if you're an elf, you can pick and choose, right? Which millennium in which you want to have your children. So why should you choose a particularly awkward millennium? So you have the tragic... not unrequited, but the tragically requited and unfulfilled love story of Eignor and Andrath. And so for years, we've been we're totally doing that in the Silmarillion project. No question, we're going to integrate that. So that was one of the other arguments, is that Eignor and Andrath and Eol and Arathel, both of those stories are going to need development in addition to the whole building Gondolin, building Nargothrond. And oh, by the way, we also need to... we want to build on the dwarf stories, mm-hmm. right? We started some interesting, what exactly are the dwarves doing in Beleriand and how are they relating to everybody else kind of thinking in season 3, which we kind of want to keep going in season 4. So, anyway.
I think I've tentatively
agreed to the split, but...
And I think this is... It's very apt, given your presentation this morning, some of the discussions about, compression for compression's sake.
Yeah.
Oh, you just got to cram. We have this amount of material, and we have to cram it into this much storytelling. So compress. And I think the decision, assuming we make the decision to split or spread out the storyline over seasons, I think that what we would be doing is we'd really be enacting the principle of tell good stories.
Tell good story, exactly.
Honestly, whatever the consequences are, if we can deliver those two love stories in a really interesting way that fills out some of the dark corners, the corners that aren't illuminated in the actual text, that actually would be really exciting. And I think that's a nice idea. And I think that's totally, both from a discussion standpoint, just having the opportunity to discuss these in detail, but also from the standpoint of imagining something that would be delivered on screen. I mean, certainly that oftentimes those are the best stories to experience in film adaptations are these character driven love stories. So. And I think these would be, and everyone loves a tragic love story. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
These are two of the most tragic. So.
Yeah, and weird. Trying to do something with Eol and Arathel, right? Just to make it not look super creepy.
Like he kidnapped her?
Because he kind of does,
yeah,
right? And yet...
Because he kidnapped her.
That one sentence in Silmarillion where the narrator says, it is not said that Arathel was entirely unwilling at the beginning. It's wow. let's unpack Entirely Unwilling. Whew, like there's a lot of story there and a lot of ways we can do that, right?
That's you true.
Know, it's like we could go like full like Stockholm Syndrome with her, or we could do some kind of, I mean, my own inclination is more like have there be some kind of attraction or interest on her part, and yet like have her, but yet nevertheless he is like, you know, enforcing his will upon her. So like he's enslaving her. He's doing the Tolkien magic thing, right? The like, I am exerting my will upon you and attempting to dominate you with my will, which is totally sketchy. And yet have her be like, you are doing this and I find that sketchy. And yet like, I am choosing of my own will to stay. And yet I also know that my will is not free, and to have her be kind of torn in these ways and see her, not just, because I don't want her just to be a victim. Arathel is one of the really strong female characters in one sense of defining strength. Mm-hmm. Strong in the sense of willing to go out and do stuff, right? Willing to stand up and say, no, I'm gonna, you know, do what I wanna do and not what I'm told to do. Not that I think that's Tolkien's ideal of strength for men or women, but nevertheless, like, you know, she's plucky. She's certainly plucky, right? And so just to have her be like, I am entranced and ensorcelled and held against my will, and I am the damsel in distress who must languish until my son grows up in order to, and then he can rescue me.
Yeah.
It's totally not how I want to do that story. I think it doesn't do justice.
This is quite
to Arathel's character.
This is quite a time in society to be trying to
it
tell
is.
That story
we,
well.
We
too.
Talked about that last week.
There's
a lot
of,
yeah.
There's clearly a lot of really bad ways we could do it too.
Absolutely.
The Stockholm syndrome, the kidnap, the I'll stay together with you because of the kid.
Well, not to mention the whole like, you know, the whole like, hi, I am, you know, the man who is fixated upon you, and I am going to like enforce my will upon you and keep you against your will. Like, there's like so many ways in which that could be horrible.
Yeah.
And should be horrible also, but I mean, it's, yeah, so like how to kind of navigate to make it horrible without just being a parody, without it being too simplistic and trying to, and it's going to be interesting. Lots of fun conversations.
A little bit of a minefield.
It is. Yeah, which I kind of relish a little bit because it's going to be fun to discuss.
That's true. It is a lot more interesting when it's a minefield.
Yes.
There was a question.
I just wanted to ask, and I wasn't sure what the timelines are in the book, but men come into Beleriand during the siege, right? The second children are waiting,
yes.
And they migrate into Beleriand.
Correct.
Prior to this, because
correct.
They're now going to become part of that story, right?
Yes.
Not that season and the following season.
Yeah, and the proposal, they will. And the proposal for the, I keep calling it the split, because I still think the whole thing is season four in my heart. But
4A and 4B.
4A and 4B, yes. That's
right, that's the
split.
Hollywood solution.
That basically, Finrod's finding of men would be the end of what would be the new season four. And season five would not focus exclusively on the men, but that would be the thing. So like the distribution of the story of Haleth, right? Talk about, we got lots of cool female characters.
Yes.
Andreth is a super strong female character. Arathel is a really interesting female character. And we get Haleth, right? Like the woman Eowyn wanted to be when she grew up, you know, for crying out loud, right? The role model that Eowyn can only look up to, you know, is Haleth. So really cool female characters in this season, or these seasons, excuse me, I guess I should say. But yes, yeah. So that's we did some talking about that, and that's another thing that's a little bit attractive about splitting it too, is that being able to. I mean, one of the things that I said in response, basically, to the whole question of should it be two seasons or one season was, really, it depends on how much we want to expand on that, right? The details that we have about what the men did in Beleriand when they arrive are very few. We could easily do them in two episodes, easily. One episode on Haleth and how Haleth became the leader of her people. One episode on like the meeting of the men and like the disguised agent of Morgoth who tries to stir them up and stuff. And then you dispose of them in their different countries and you're set, right? We could easily do that. Or we could invest in their stories a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I find the idea of, like, I think I would much rather see Hoth be a main character who's like recurring repeatedly.
Yes, and let's tell the story of Hoth in a season arc instead of just.
That sounds very exciting. That's a character I want to spend a lot of time with.
And I agree. And it was pointed out that if we didn't extend the season into more than one season, we would be shoving Hoth into a corner, because the problem with these mortals is they just die like that. So if we don't tell Hoth's story now, we're not going to get another chance.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's true. But the elves, you can kind of keep them around.
Yeah, we can postpone almost indefinitely the character development of some of these elves. But the humans, it's not so easy.
What did you guys decide to do with Galadriel's character?
That was a big decision. So we did not choose Tolkien's later ideas, like where he totally wanted to differentiate. We rolled with, I can't remember the categories that I made, which one. I think it was 2.0 that we decided on.
Yeah, it was either 2 or 3. No,
two.
It wasn't 3.
It wasn't
3.
3 is the whole hog.
Yeah.
Yeah, she goes off on her own boat.
Which Galadriel is the most... I was gonna say evil, but which one's the most complicated one?
I think two.
I think we're
not
exactly that, but close to that.
Yeah. One of the things that
we're leaning into ambitious, like, conquer new lands, Galadriel.
Okay.
We want to do problematic Galadriel.
Okay.
Yeah.
But not butchering the Teleri.
She was
not party to the
not,
right. She wasn't party to the
Kinslayer.
What?
Just with the Fingolfin's troops.
Yeah, those Fingolfin's troops are not innocent at the Kinslaying. So yeah, we wanted.
But I think we left her hands unstained.
Yes,
yeah,
we it was a Galadriel at the Kinslaying was a delicate dance.
Yep.
Because what I wanted to have two things, two apparently contradictory things. I agreed that there was a big uproar against. I think I proposed that I wanted to have her kill folks. I
yes.
wanted her to be guilty at the Kinslaying. And there was an uprising. And so I yielded. But I wanted her to be guilty, not to be able to be like distant and saying like, well, I didn't have anything to do with the Kinslaying.
Right.
She did have something to do with the Kinslaying. And like, again, the people Fingolfin are, you know, in this kind of marginalized place, right? Finarfin was not there, right? He didn't fight. Fëanor and his people started it. Fingolfin, they fought, right?
Yeah.
They killed people
at
the Kinsland. They intervened. So we had Galadriel with the people intervening. The way that we ended up having it, actually, was Galadriel not having blood on her hands, but having blood splashed on her clothes, basically. She will emerge physically stained. Like, she was complicit in a... Like, she didn't actually kill anybody, but she was ready to. And it was literally, like, at least on the point of decision. And then in the end, like, she didn't do it, but it was close.
Technicality.
Yeah, yeah. She would totally... She would,
accessory.
If she were just, like, if she had only even a mediocre defense attorney, she'd get off.
And I'm trying to remember sort of what the complication there was, but I think it was downstream consequences if she was proactively involved in murdering people. That basically there's no way she would have been allowed to stick around
or have a ring of power, I think was the issue.
Well,
too,
and it's and, yeah, and because it's like her mom, you know, I mean, like it's they're her people.
Yeah.
And so like to have her cross that line, you know, to slay her mother's kin, we felt was in the end too much of a line for her to cross.
Yeah.
And yet the way that we set up the Kinslaying was really fun. That was one of the
that was really fun.
One of the most fun discussions we had. We
equaled only by the debate over the
the
biology of Middle Earth.
Oh, the biology! Oh my goodness! Oh the Dolore!
Yeah,
that.
Remind
us to come back to the Sleep of Yavanna. One of the most divisive discussions we've had in film. But anyway, though really illustrative in very interesting ways. But no, the Kinslaying was really cool because the way we wanted to conceive that was we wanted it to be understandable from every perspective, right? There's nobody even Fëanor, even I don't want even Fëanor to emerge from this just looking like some kind of crazed, you know, evil person ready to bite the heads off babies without provocation, right? I mean, it's like you need at least to be able to understand, like, you can disapprove of what he did, right? But you need at least to understand why he did it, to have some kind of empathy for the temptation that drove him to make that call, even if you would quite like to think you wouldn't make a different call in his place, right? That's what I wanted for Fëanor and for everyone, right? So so the way that we constructed it was we tried to construct it in such a way so that it looked, it was like one of those situations that just escalated kind of out of control. And from each point of view, it kind of, it looked different and sort of, you could sort of understand both sides, right? You know, so the way, even with we didn't have the Fëanorians march down to the docks with their swords drawn and start hacking up folks, right? And here we were following the text. They take the ships and just sail away with the ships, right? So we start with the Fëanorians just getting on the ships and starting attempting to take off with them. We were pointing out the fact that the Fëanorians won't have the first idea how to sail a ship, actually. So there would be some inefficiencies in the departure of the fleet from the harbor. And the Teleri objecting, right? No, don't. But of course, like, what are they going to do? Like, they would sort of start off with, like, stop, or we're going to keep asking you to stop, right? And then, but then, like, there comes a point, right, where they're like, okay, no. Even though we've told you to stop, you're not stopping, right? We have to stop you, right? And they start it. You know, they're the ones who begin the violence, like non-lethally, right? It's like it starts with fisticuffs, and it's the Fëanorians who then escalate it from fisticuffs to swords, which they have and the Teleri don't, right? But again, now you're the Fëanorians, right? You're being attacked, right? People are assaulting you on the ship. You're defending yourself. And then there's Teleri archers. So the way that the harbor is described, right, there's this bridge, this arch above the exit to the harbor. So we have the Teleri with bows, right? We know they have bows. So we have archers up there on the edge, and they're ready to shoot the Fëanorians as they're coming out. And that's when Fingolfin enters. So Fingolfin and his host come in, and what they see are the Teleri lining, the ready to shoot, to murder the Fëanorians as the Fëanorians are. Because by this time, all of the Teleri who have actually physically attacked the ships have been dealt with, right? So all they see are the Fëanorians going into a trap, which for all they know, and following Fëanor's words in the previous episode, is a trap like orchestrated by the Valar, right? This is the Valar attempting to stop them, right? And trying to kill them all. And here's the Teleri serving as their instruments. And so seeing his people, Fingolfin, seeing his people, the people of Fëanor, about to be attacked, as far as he can see, you know, one-sidedly, unprovokedly, by the Teleri, attacks, right, to prevent them from killing all of the Fëanorians. And that's how, and Galadriel's with him. We had Galadriel with him. So we have Galadriel on the bridge. Actually, not far, and we killed off Eärendil, didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah, her mom dies in the Kinslay. Galadriel's mom, and
that's
mom's
what
on the
provokes
bridge.
Her, sort of like that. That's what, like, she's restrained until her mother is in danger.
Yeah, yeah. But we actually had Galadriel like charging with Fingolfin.
Yeah,
like she was ready to mix it up. Like she was appalled, right? Like because it was like a betrayal, as far as they can see, right? But then, in the end, she stops, right, and is appalled. And we had one of my favorite sort of cinematic, you know, moments from that whole season 3, is the scene at the very end of that of episode 2 of the Kinslaying episode, when Fingolfin is on the center of the span of the bridge. You know, with the blood of the Teleri on him, and Fëanor is on the lead ship sailing underneath, and Fingolfin looks down, you know, he's got blood literally on his hands, and he looks down, and Fëanor, standing with his bloody sword on the ship, is looking up at him, and the two of them, like, their eyes meet as he comes and sails underneath the the bridge. See. So anyway, it's just thinking through this stuff, but because this is the kind of thing, like the description of the kinsling is like one paragraph.
Yep. Right.
Right. But the, you know, the kind of ways that we end up talking a lot when we do this in film is like, but this must have happened, right? Something like this have happened. Like, it doesn't make sense to just be like, have the Fëanorians and the other Noldor just be like, we're going to butcher the Teleri because we enjoy it, you know? Yeah. And like, it's, no, like, that wouldn't happen that way. Why would Fingolfin do this? Why would they, yeah.
How much do you think, percentage-wise, or even looking ahead, are you going to be pulling from other sources? Like you've already said, you're pulling from Morgoth's Ring, you know, stuff like that. How much do you pull from other writings? And still, I mean, you're called Silmarillion Seminar, so you're going to be pulling.
So basically, we...
Wantonly.
Yeah, wantonly. That's exactly it.
Just whenever.
Whatever.
Like we've done this with Bulldog, right?
Yeah, Bulldog. Absolutely.
I just remember back in the beginning, you're trying to like devise the characters of the Valar. Are you going to look them at the Unfinished Tales Valar? Are you going to do these, you know?
Yeah, it's tricky. Basically, we just kind of pick and choose
what
we think is coolest.
Yeah.
Exactly. So like, for instance, one change that we made totally, not, which, you know, would surprise Silmarillion fans, but is we didn't make it up. We killed off one of the Sons of Fëanor.
Yes.
At the burning of the ships, there's one of his later writings. He has Amrod, one of the two twins, is burned alive in one of the ships when he burns the ships, which you know. So we were like, we think this story is cool. So we are going to tell this version of the story. But there are some other things that, like, you know, other like the what his later versions of the Galadriel story. Where he really wanted to make Galadriel he wanted to divorce Galadriel almost completely from the wrongdoing in the First Age. So he's like, she got her own boat to Middle-earth, right? She wasn't even involved. She's not even under the doom of the Noldor, kind of, you know, sort of.
That's an example where we're like, boring.
We're not doing that.
Evil Galadriel, way more interesting.
Because we want, and again, this, playing the long game, right? We are totally playing the long game in some film project. We are like, we want that moment when Galadriel does not take the ring, right? We are playing, like, that moment is going to be so powerful because these people, these incredibly patient, wholly theoretical people who have been watching our entirely theoretical show for 25 seasons by
that
time, right? Oh man, that's gonna mean so much, right? Like, I mean, like, Frodo is gonna be a bit part in that scene, right? I mean, it's not about it; it's about, you know. So this kind of glimpse that you get of what it means, you know, when she says, "I pass the test, I shall diminish and go into the West." Oh man, like, that's gonna be the climax of a long story, and we want to give that story full credit. But of course, you know, who's the primary hero? The one character. Whose story arc reaches from the beginning of season one all the way to the very end of season 30 or whatever it is, the one single character whose long story unifies the entire thread of the story?
Tolkien?
Sauron. Sauron. Sauron is our longest game that we're playing the entire time.
Yeah.
One of the major subplots of season one is the temptation of Myron. Morgoth's recruitment of Myron to become his servant is one of the things that, and his decision to kind of come over is one of the things that happens towards the end of season one. And then his, like, trying to find his place among, like, the, you know, the evil lowerarchy, right, in Morgoth's world in season two and three.
And I think, like, the idea with Myron is we don't want him to be recognizable.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, it's virtually impossible. Like in reality, this wouldn't work. I guess you could imagine an entire generation of people who never read the books or didn't have access to Wikipedia or friends.
Or
no information. But the idea would be, if you could imagine someone like that, you would like that person to watch this character and then be invested in this character of Myron as a person undergoing a fall and becoming a villain in their own right, and then at the end be like, oh shoot, that's Sauron.
That's Sauron. Oh, exactly. Crap. It's like this shocking reveal.
And not like figure that out at the end of season one, but figure that out when it's revealed on screen in season 34.
You gotta have a what?
A decoy Sauron.
A decoy Sauron.
Yeah, maybe.
That's right.
You know, and like that's the interesting thing about this this experience you're talking about, sort of the idea that like you could imagine if you watched 25 years of this show, it's like a soap opera, and that's it. The only thing that's even comparable that actually exists in the world today would be a soap opera.
It would be a soap opera.
Seriously, no kidding.
Yeah, but you could imagine going through the exercise of actually watching that for a better part of a quarter of, you know, hopefully we all live that one, a quarter of your life, and arriving at that point in Lothlorien. And really, you would be looking at it as like, you know, Frodo, this character who was just introduced like a season or two ago, and then Galadriel, this person you've been watching, you know, it's like Erica Kane on All My Children. You know, somebody you've like watched on screen for like 20, 30 years or whatever. You could imagine like that you've lived with that character way longer. So yeah, it really would be Frodo would be like the kind of the sideshow to that. And the interesting thing is, that's the closest we can get to, like, you know that experience of reading the description of the Third Age at the end of the Silmarillion, where you're like, you know, oh, this is the elf point of view about those events. Yeah. Events that, you know, for a lot of us, like, resonate, you know, like, we feel closer to that text than the Silmarillion because it's told at the ground level, and that's where we read it at. You know, and you get to have that fun moment where it's like, you know, Frodo and his servant, unnamed.
Frodo alone with his servant.
The guy who is almost universally agreed to be the actual hero of the story,
right.
But is unnamed. Like, the closest we could get to actually really experiencing that story in that way, to understanding that elf point of view about the story, would be watching a TV adaptation of Silmarillion that lasted 30 years, and then arriving at Lord of the Rings, and really feeling like, you know, this feels like a coda at the end of like this much more epic tale, and like, you know, here's this guy, yeah, Frodo, whatever, Galadriel, all right, yeah,
that's right.
It's very interesting. I hadn't really thought about that way, but that is like it's like a way to very kind of access that elf point of view.
Yeah, yeah, which is very Silmarillion.
Yes,
that's kind of one of the goals, is to help people kind of enter into that in some ways. And yeah, talk about a different angle on the Lord of the Rings, right? Come at it from the perspective where it looks to you like a brief final chapter, you know, in a much, much longer. And the difference in perspective, I mean, there's so many times, again, we are so about the long game in the film project, right? There's so many times when we're already setting things up, like, we want to have this scene look exactly like this moment in the Lord of the Rings, so that when we get there 20 years from now, the visual echo, like, you will remember. So, like, in particular, you remember in The Return of the King, when Théoden charges on the Pelennor Field, right? And who's he compared to?
Orome.
Which means we need an Orome scene, right? So in episode 13 of season 1, when Orome leads the charge in, we need to have that set up.
The grass turns green.
Exactly. So that when Théoden comes in, you'll get the echo. You'll be like, oh my gosh, he's just like Orome! Because Orome came first, and you know it, right?
Yeah, which again is such an interesting way to experience that. You know, like when you actually read it, you're like, oh yeah, like Orome in this abstract notion. Like, I understand
which
the
Which I
metaphor.
Suppose is cool, yeah.
Yes, that's I get it. That's a metaphor for reasons kind of godly, but imagine experiencing that scene where you've actually visually witnessed Orome riding.
Where your experience is, oh my gosh, he looks just like Orome in that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like on your own, like spontaneously, the simile comes to you, you know? Like that's what we're going for. It is this kind of perspective. I mean, of course, how long running the show is going to be has been a sort of a running joke all the way through. But it does really present some very, very fascinating opportunities. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, there's I mentioned before in regard to season one and thinking about faithfulness and making changes, right? Some of the changes that we've made. So there are two. Do we have time to talk about two things?
I've been given a 5-minute warning. So
I can talk exceptionally briefly about two things.
Probably going to have to split it in two.
Okay, so, does that mean I can get 10 minutes? Or I can get
wrong. Remember, we're coming back at the end. So
okay,
can,
that's
okay.
True.
So two quick things. just which both of which sort of illustrate some of the opportunities and challenges. And again, these are some of the things which have also really contributed to expanding my own understanding of what it means to do adaptation. Morgoth.
Yep.
In season one. Right. If you've read The Silmarillion, you know. Morgoth is Morgoth from page one. Right. Maybe not page one. You could make an argument he's still in the process of falling in the Ainulindale, right? But when he arrives in Middle Earth, he arrives, you know, in wrath as he's the Dark Lord from the moment he arrives in Middle Earth. And we decided we don't want to do that. We wanted the main plot, the main story arc of season one to be the fall of Morgoth. And the way in which that impacts the rest of the Valar, like the other Valar coming to grips with what it means to be fallen, they've not experienced this before, right? What fallen looks like. So we show the temptation of Morgoth, these intermediary stages when he has his own insidious plans, which are kind of twisted, but he's still fooling himself and kind of liking to believe that he's still the good guy, right? Then later stages, when he's at least trying to fool other people into thinking that he's still the good guy. And then to the final stages, where he is still in a sense convinced, of course, that he's in the right, but now has changed his mind about, what is that Saruman line, right? There would need be no change in our ends, only in our means, right? That's sort of where he kind of comes to in the end. And so thinking through what is, because it's a story which Tolkien kind of embeds in so much of his work, right? The fall of people, how good people with good intentions fall and become evildoers is a story that Tolkien is really good at. But he doesn't tell it about Morgoth. And we were like, come on,
really?
Man. Like, we need to start there, right?
Even Sauron, right?
Even Sauron, we don't really get it. I mean, we get kind of glimpses. Or
we get like a starting point and an end
and
point,
an end point.
And some
yeah.
references to some middle points. But
yeah, but not too much. So
yeah.
Both of those things. And of course, the way that we have those things going along together, Morgoth going first, Sauron following behind, but not too far behind. He's only really a couple steps behind down the path. But they don't proceed at the same paces, necessarily. Morgoth kind of goes over the cliff, especially at the Darkening of Valinor.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of season three, post-Darkening of Valinor, when he's now, the tyrant in Angband with the Iron Crown and the Silmarils and the Burned Hand and everything, Morgoth is now... Well, he's Morgoth. We shift... We use the nomenclature, right? We cease to call him Melkor and we begin to call him Morgoth, and when he really sort of owns that, right? He really embodies that for the first time in season
three.
That's
another thing in the published Silmarillion, that transition, Melkor
yes.
to Morgoth.
Melkor
that's another
Melkor.
Thing where it's just, there's like a sentence that explains like, oh, this is what the elves call him.
Yeah.
Or like, when you actually set about trying to tell how that's going to work, then you actually get to see how he arrives at that moniker.
Thinking about his identity and his own self-identification and understanding.
That's an interesting point. Everyone here knows that one of the common critiques of Tolkien from people who are Tolkien fans is usually that like his world's black and white. Something that most folks in this room, I'm sure, probably agree is like not true, and we all reject that critique. But the critique is the good guys are good, the bad guys are bad. And there aren't many examples of great characters, which is wrong. There's plenty of them. But I think one kernel of truth in that is the sense that most of the bad guys, as they're portrayed in the book, are bad. But as you point out, there actually is, if you bother to look into them a little bit and think about them, there really is Tolkien really is good at telling false stories. It's just that, people, especially modern readers, are looking to see that in the page. They want it as they're reading this, as they're reading Lord of the Rings, they would like to see a villain who falls that way.
Or doubts himself in some way.
But when you go through this exercise, like, well, we're going to try and fill out this history, it really does make you realize, no, it actually has fantastic villains.
Yeah.
It's just that most of the stories that he tells, at least the ones that are popularly read, are ones that are told at the point where that person has already become...
Yeah.
the as realize their full villain potential.
Yes. Yes.
But like actually, like when you start thinking about how did Morgoth arrive there? How did Sauron arrive there? Actually, it's really fascinating.
It's
story.
Really fun.
Yeah.
So we found ourselves in this position right away in season one of making enormous and wholesale changes to the story. Because it flatly contradicts the published Silmarillion, which plainly says that he's already like the evil tyrant from when he first enters the world. But at the same time, it's not like we're just saying, forget Tolkien's story, we're going off in a totally different direction. We were trying to do Tolkien's story in a different sense, right? So again, this is, one of the things which has been leading me over the last several years to be like, what does faithful mean? Right, I would still call our, film adaptation a faithful adaptation because we're engaging with the story. We're thinking through Tolkien's ideas, even if we've deviated from the actual plot, that he gave.
Right. It's similar in a sense to Jackson and the Hobbit.
In some ways.
At least in the sense that it's evident from the changes we're making. The irony is that in making changes, we're engaging with the text far more deeply than we ever did before when we just read it and appreciated it for what it was, and that's the way it is. Even as we're saying, well, we're going to have to change that, that's never going to work, we're gaining a deeper understanding of the actual text, even as we say, like, well, we can do this better.
Exactly. Both in big ways and small ways.
Yes.
Big ways as far as, like, major themes and thinking through things we haven't confronted to small details, which... as soon as you think about them, blossom into, like the kinslaying, right? We spent like 3/4 of an episode on this one little digression. The question was really simple. What do we show the Teleri doing on screen? Like the surviving ones, not the ones who die. We know what they'll do. But like the survivors, like what does the aftermath of the kinslaying look like? Which led us to ask the question, which I'd never asked in my entire life, do elves mourn for their dead? And if they do, how and why? And as soon as I asked that question, my immediate assumption, right, was like the Teleri, like, weeping and wailing and kneeling over the corpses and like holding broken corpses, why? And then I'm like, wait, would they do that? Why would they do that? It's like, why would you move down the street to Mandos and come back before too long? But we didn't want to make it meaningless. We can't at the end be like, well, they're dead. That is a temporary inconvenience. It's got to mean something. But what does it mean?
Yeah.
Right? So the challenges of thinking through, what is the Elvish point of view on these things? Right? We can't just project human response. Because for humans, it's a big deal. Right? Death is a big deal. Right? That person's gone, and they're not coming back. And will you ever see them again? Who knows, right? Not so with the elves, right? She's going to be gone for, who knows, a few millennia, right? I'll miss her for a time, but then she'll come back. And so we begin to ask questions like, will they be the same? How are they affected by death? Is there a sense of loss? Is something lost? If so, what exactly? And again, how do you respond? When you're standing over the corpse of your dead loved one, and you're an elf. How does that hit you? What do you think? And I mean, we spent like an hour and a half talking about. There's just like one tiny thing,
it just kind of
emerged. Bizarre. As we were like, oh, and the Teleri are going to be really upset, and I'm like, wait, will they? Yeah. So I mean, some like tiny little details which become huge things, and other again major things like thinking about. Fall and these patterns of fall and these other bigger things.
before during this panel, for people that don't follow Silm Film and want to see the art and listen to the music, should they find it?
Yeah, they can. So the where the creative force behind Silm Film lives is on our discussion forums. So if you go to forums.signumuniversity.org. I believe that is correct.
We'll tweet it out.
Yeah. you can see all of the and that's where all of our Signum forms are, and the Silm Film is one of those. So you click on Silm Film, and it's divided by season and then by particular creative threads. Some threads are devoted to discussions of, that is to say, complaining about the things that we've said, you know, in the podcast episodes. That's where the revolts occur, generally.
There's always, like, I think the casting.
Oh, and the, yeah. Casting
discussions are really
major,
fun.
Yeah, heated discussions about casting. Yeah. But again, it's kind of awkward because we've now cast almost every major actor and actress in Hollywood.
Yeah, running out.
Really. Talk about unrestricted budgets. But
are they going to age out of these roles? Or?
Well, see, it is awkward.
Oh, boy.
This is one of the big challenges, right? Like, casting Galadriel, for instance, right? Who's going to look unchanged in 20 years is going to be tricky, right? Very,
by then,
very
it'll be
tricky.
All CGI.
Yeah.
Motion capture.
Quite likely. Yeah. Yeah. So it's
that means it opens up to anybody who's got motion capture up. Right?
See, that was one of the arguments for dead actors in the first place. Yeah. Exactly. That was it. Especially when with Peter Cushing reprising his role posthumously was an inspiration to us, but that we got shut down.
Well, then we saw CGI Carrie Fisher reprising hers, and then we were like,
maybe not.
All right.
But anyway, so yes, that's where you can find the forms. The episodes are on YouTube, and they're also, so if you go to I would recommend in general, the Signum University YouTube channel is a good thing to subscribe to, because all of the episodes of all of the things are posted there, pretty much. A lot of people, I think mostly because, of course, like what I have been doing for years started as just a podcast. Most people who follow the stuff still like think iTunes first and everything else second. In this Signum and Mythgard world,
you can download podcasts, you can't download YouTube.
I know. No, it's so. Totally fine. But like, what I'm saying is our own distribution.
That's where it's gonna come first.
Yeah, YouTube will be first. Sure. That's like we think of it as YouTube first and podcast second in many ways. Now,
if you go to the Mythgard website, you can subscribe to the go-to webinar calendar invite, so you know when we're recording live. You can join us live. Post feedback and questions that we may answer or may ignore.
You guys look at the forums pretty regularly.
Yeah.
You sift through the contributions there.
Yeah, exactly. No,
yep.
those discussions are
That's
very
right.
much a
yep.
part of what we do.
We record, in case you didn't know, we record every other Friday, 7 a.m. Pacific time, so a little early for you and for me. I think the next one probably is this coming Friday, right?
It's coming Friday.
From
yesterday.
So any given Friday, I might live tweet it or I might forget. There's actually a lot of ways to be involved. It's a lot of fun.
It's funny, Dave. I almost corrected you, and I'm like, no, it's at 10. Oh, no, wait. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
We're in California, of course. It's at 10. Yes.
Yep. So, all right, let's take our break. We have our last presentation, and then we'll have discussions. Yeah.